For the next 10 minutes, he tried to collect himself as he moved cautiously around the grocery store, peeking around corners, reading labels, inspecting meats, watching the other shoppers for signs of his assailant or perhaps another one. When he was somewhat convinced the man was gone, he hurried to the lone open cashier, quickly paid for his pizza, and left the store. He strolled to his car, eyes darting in all directions, and was safely locked inside with the engine on when he realized there would be more trouble. A pickup had wheeled to a stop behind Stanley's Volvo, blocking it. A parked van faced it and prevented a forward escape. This angered Stanley. He turned off the ignition, yanked open his driver's door, and was climbing out when he saw the man approaching quickly from the pickup. Then he saw the gun, a large black pistol. Stanley managed to offer a weak, "What the hell?" before the hand without the gun slapped him across the face and knocked him against the driver's door. For a moment he saw nothing, but was aware of being grabbed, then dragged and thrown into the pickup and slid across the vinyl front seat. The hand around the back of his neck was thick, strong, violent. Stanley's neck was skinny and weak, and for some reason, in the horror of the moment, he admitted to himself that this man could easily snap his neck and with only one hand. Another man was driving, a very young man, probably just a kid. A door slammed. Stanley's head was stuffed down near the floorboard, cold steel jammed into the base of his skull. "Go," the man said, and the pickup jerked forward. "Don't move and don't say a word or I'll blow your brains out," the man said, his high voice quite agitated. "Okay, okay," Stanley managed to say. His left arm was pinned behind his back, and for good measure the man jerked it up until Stanley flinched in pain. The pain continued for a minute or so, then suddenly the man let go. The pistol was taken away from Stanley's head. "Sit up," the man said, and Stanley raised himself, shook his head, adjusted his glasses, and tried to focus. They were on the outskirts of town, headed west. A few seconds passed, and nothing was said. To his left was the kid driving, a teenager of no more than 16, a slight boy with bangs and pimples and eyes that revealed an equal amount of surprise and bewilderment. His youth and innocence were oddly comforting. Surely, this thug wouldn't shoot him in front of a boy. To his right, with their legs touching, was the man with a gun, which was temporarily resting on his beefy right knee and aimed at no one in particular. More silence as they left Clanton behind. Lawyer Wade took deep, quiet breaths and managed to calm himself somewhat as he tried to arrange his thoughts and address the scenario of being abducted. "Okay, Lawyer Wade, what have you done in 23 years of practicing law to deserve this? Whom did you sue? Who got left out of a will? Maybe a bad divorce? Who was on the losing side of a lawsuit?" When the boy turned off the highway and onto a paved county road, Stanley finally said, "Mind if I ask where we're going?" Ignoring the question, the man said, "Name's Cranwell, Jim Cranwell. That's my son, Doyle." That lawsuit. Stanley swallowed hard and noticed for the first time the dampness around his neck and collar. He was still wearing his dark gray suit, white cotton shirt, drab maroon tie, and the entire outfit suddenly made him hot. He was sweating, and his heart thumped like a jackhammer. Cranwell versus Train. 8 or 9 years ago, Stanley defended Dr. Train in a nasty, contentious, emotional, and ultimately successful trial. A bitter loss for the Cranwell family. A great win for Dr. Train and his lawyer. But Stanley didn't feel so victorious now. The fact that Mr. Cranwell so freely divulged his name and that of his son meant only one thing, at least to Stanley. Mr. Cranwell had no fear of being identified, because his victim would not be able to talk. That black pistol over there would find some action after all. A wave of nausea vibrated through Stanley's midsection, and for a second, he considered where to unload his vomit. Not to the right, and not to the left. Straight down, between his feet. He clenched his teeth and swallowed rapidly, and the moment passed. "I ask where we're going," he said, in a rather feeble effort to show some resistance, but his words were hollow and scratchy. His mouth was very dry. "It's best if you just shut up," Jim Cranwell said. Being in no position to argue or press his inquiries, Stanley decided to shut up. Minutes passed as they drove deeper into the county along Route 32, a busy road during the day but deserted at night. Stanley knew the area well. He'd lived in Ford County for 25 years, and it was a small place. His breathing slowed again, as did his heart rate, and he concentrated on absorbing the details around him. The truck, a late 1980s Ford, half-ton, metallic gray on the outside, he thought, and some shade of dark blue on the inside. The dash was standard, nothing remarkable. On the sun visor above the driver, there was a thick rubber band holding papers and receipts. 194,000 miles on the odometer, not unusual for this part of the world. The kid was driving a steady 50 miles an hour. He turned off Route 32 onto Wiser Lane, a small paved road that snaked through the western part of the county and eventually crossed the Tallahatchie River at the Polk County line. The roads were getting narrower, the woods thicker, Stanley's options fewer, his chances slimmer. He glanced at the pistol and thought of his brief career as an assistant prosecutor many years earlier, and the occasions when he took the tagged murder weapon, showed it to the jurors, and waved it around the courtroom, trying his best to create drama, fear, and a sense of revenge. Would there be a trial for his murder? Would that rather large pistol? He guessed it was a .44 Magnum, capable of splattering his brains across a half acre of rural farmland, one day be waved around a courtroom as the system dealt with his gruesome homicide? "Why don't you say something?" Stanley asked without looking at Jim Cranwell. Anything was better than silence. If Stanley had a chance, it would be because of his words, his ability to reason or beg. "Your client, Dr. Train, he left town, didn't he?" Cranwell said. Well, at least Stanley had the right lawsuit, which gave him no comfort whatsoever. He said, "Yes, several years ago." "Where'd he go?" "I'm not sure." "He got in some trouble, didn't he?" "Yes, you could say that." "I just did." "What kind of trouble?" "I don't remember." "Lying ain't gonna help you, Lawyer Wade. You know damn well what happened to Dr. Train. He was a drunk and a drug head, and he couldn't stay out of his own little pharmacy. Got hooked on painkillers, lost his license, left town, tried to hide back home in Illinois." These details were offered as if they were common knowledge, available every morning at the local coffee shops and dissected over lunch at the garden clubs, when in fact the meltdown of Dr. Train had been handled discreetly by Stanley's firm and buried, or so he thought. The fact that Jim Cranwell had so closely monitored things after the trial made Stanley wipe his brow and shift his weight and once again fight thoughts of throwing up. That sounds about right," Stanley said. "You ever talk to Dr. Train?" "No, it's been years." "Word is he disappeared again. You heard this?" "No, it was a lie." Stanley and his partners had heard several rumors about the puzzling disappearance of Dr. Train. He'd fled to Peoria, his home, where he regained his license and resumed his medical practice, but couldn't stay out of trouble. Roughly 2 years earlier, his then-current wife had called around Clanton, asking old friends and acquaintances if they'd seen him. The boy turned again, onto a road with no sign, a road Stanley thought perhaps he'd driven past but never noticed. It was also paved, but barely wide enough for two vehicles to pass. So far, the kid had not made a sound. "They'll never find him," Jim Cranwell said, almost to himself, but with a brutal finality. Stanley's head was spinning. His vision was blurred. He blinked, rubbed his eyes, breathed heavily with his mouth open, and felt his shoulders sag as he absorbed and digested these last words from the man with the gun. Was he, Stanley, supposed to believe that these backwoods people from deep in the county somehow tracked down Dr. Train and rubbed him out without getting caught? Yes. Stop up there at Baker's Gate, Cranwell said to his son. 100 yards later, the truck stopped. Cranwell opened the door, waved the pistol, and said, Get out. He grabbed Stanley by the wrist and led him to the front of the truck, shoved him against the hood, spread eagle, and said, Don't move an inch. Then he whispered some instructions to his son, who got back in the truck. Cranwell grabbed Stanley again, yanked him to the side of the road, and down into a shallow ditch, where they stood as the truck drove away. They watched the taillights disappear around a curve. Cranwell pointed the gun at the road and said, Start walking. Stanley said, You won't get away with this, you know. Just shut up and walk. They began walking down the dark, potholed road. Stanley went first, with Cranwell 5 feet behind him. The night was clear, and a half moon gave enough light to keep them in the center of the road. Stanley looked to his right and left and back again, in a hopeless search for the distant lights of a small farm. Nothing. You run and you're a dead man, Cranwell said. Keep your hands out of your pockets. Why? You think I have a gun? Shut up and keep walking. Where would I run to? Stanley asked, without missing a step. Without a sound, Cranwell suddenly lunged forward and threw a mighty punch that landed on the back of Stanley's slender neck and dropped him quickly to the asphalt. The gun was back, at his head, and Cranwell was on top of him, growling. You're a little smartass, you know that, Wade? You were a smartass at trial. You're a smartass now. You were born a smartass. I'm sure your mama was a smartass, and I'm sure your kids, both of them, are too. Can't help it, can you? But listen to me, you little smartass. For the next hour, you will not be a smartass. You got that, Wade? Wade was stunned, groggy, aching, and not sure if he could hold back the vomit. When he didn't respond, Cranwell jerked his collar, yanked him back so that Stanley was on his knees. Got any last words, Lawyer Wade? The barrel of the gun was stuck in his ear. Don't do this, man, Stanley pleaded, suddenly ready to cry. Oh, why not? Cranwell hissed from above. I have a family. Please don't do this. I got kids too, Wade. You met both of them. Doyle is driving the truck. Michael's the one you met at trial, the little brain-damaged boy who'll never drive, walk, talk, eat, or take a piss by himself. Why, Lawyer Wade? Because of your dear client, Dr. Train. May he burn in hell. I'm sorry, really, I mean it. I was just doing my job. Please. The gun was shoved harder so that Stanley's head tilted to the left. He was sweating, gasping, desperate to say something that might save him. Cranwell grabbed a handful of Stanley's thinning hair, yanked it, said, Well, your job stinks, Wade, because it includes lying, bullying, badgering, covering up, and showing no compassion whatsoever for folks who get hurt. I hate your job, Wade, almost as much as I hate you. I'm sorry, please. Cranwell pulled the barrel out of Stanley's ear, aimed down the dark road, and, with the gun about 8 inches from his head, pulled the trigger. A cannon would have made less noise in the stillness. Stanley, who had never been shot, shrieked in horror and pain and death and fell to the pavement, his ears screaming and his body convulsing. A few seconds passed as the gunshot's echo was absorbed into the thick woods. A few more seconds, and Cranwell said, Get up, you little creep. Stanley, still unshot but uncertain about it, slowly began to realize what had happened. He got up, unsteady, still gasping and unable to speak or hear. Then he realized his pants were wet. In his moment of death, he had lost control of his bladder. He touched his groin, then his legs. You pissed on yourself, Cranwell said. Stanley heard him, but barely. His ears were splitting, especially the right one. You poor boy, all wet with piss. Michael wets himself 5 times a day. Sometimes we can afford diapers, sometimes we can't. Now walk. Cranwell shoved him again, roughly, while pointing down the road with the pistol. Stanley stumbled, almost fell, but caught himself, and staggered for a few steps, till he could focus and balance and convince himself that he had not, in fact, been shot. You ain't ready to die, Cranwell said from behind. Thank God for that, Stanley almost said, but caught himself, because it would most certainly be taken as another smart-ass comment. Lurching down the road, he vowed to avoid all other smart-ass comments, or anything even remotely similar. He put a finger in his right ear in an effort to stop the ringing. His crotch and legs felt cold from the moisture. They walked for another 10 minutes, though it seemed like an eternal death march to Stanley. Rounding a curve in the road, he saw lights ahead, a small house in the distance. He picked up his pace slightly as he decided that Cranwell was not about to fire again with someone within earshot. The house was a small brick split level, 100 yards off the road, with a gravel drive and neat hedges just below the front windows. 4 vehicles were parked haphazardly along the drive and in the yard, as if the neighbors had hurried over for a quick supper. One was the Ford pickup, once driven by Doyle, now parked in front of the garage. 2 men were smoking under a tree. This way, Cranwell said, pointing with the gun and shoving Stanley toward the house. They walked by the 2 smokers. Look what I got, Cranwell said. The men blew clouds of smoke but said nothing. He pissed on himself, he added, and they thought it was amusing. They walked across the front yard, past the door, past the garage, around the far side of the house, and in the back they approached a cheap, unpainted plywood addition someone had stuck on like a cancerous growth. It was attached to the house but could not be seen from the road. It had unbalanced windows, exposed pipes, a flimsy door, the sad look of a room added as cheaply and quickly as possible. Cranwell stuck a hand on Stanley's bruised neck and shoved him toward the door. In here, he said, the gun as always giving direction. The only way in was up a short wheelchair ramp, one as rickety as the room itself. The door opened from inside. People were waiting. 8 years earlier, during the trial, Michael had been 3 years old. He had been displayed for the jury only once. During his lawyer's emotional final summation, the judge allowed Michael to be rolled into the courtroom in his special chair for a quick viewing. He wore pajamas, a large bib, no socks or shoes. His oblong head fell to one side. His mouth was open, his eyes were closed, and his tiny misshapen body wanted to curl into itself. He was severely brain damaged, blind, with a life expectancy of only a few years. He was a pitiful sight then, though the jury eventually showed no mercy. Stanley had endured the moment along with everyone else in the courtroom, but when Michael was rolled away, he got back to business. He was convinced he would never see the child again. He was wrong. He was now looking at a slightly larger version of Michael, though a more pathetic one. He was wearing pajamas and a bib, no socks or shoes. His mouth was open, his eyes closed. His face had grown upward into a long, sloping forehead, covered in part by thick, black, matted hair. A tube ran from his left nostril back to some unseen place. His arms were bent at the wrists and curled under. His knees were drawn to his chest. His belly was large, and for an instant he reminded Stanley of those sad photos of starving children in Africa. Michael was arranged on his bed, an old leftover from some hospital, propped up with pillows and lashed down with a Velcro strap that fit loosely across his chest. At the foot of his bed was his mother, a gaunt, long-suffering soul whose name Stanley could not immediately recall. He had made her cry on the witness stand. At the other end of the bed was a small bathroom with the door open, and next to the door was a black metal file cabinet with two drawers, legal size, and enough scratches and dents to prove it had passed through a dozen flea markets. The wall next to Michael's bed had no windows, but the two walls along the sides had three narrow windows each. The room was 15 feet long at most, and about 12 feet wide. The floor was covered with cheap, yellow linoleum. "Sit here, Lawyer Wade," Jim said, shoving his prisoner into a folding chair in the center of the small room. The pistol was no longer in sight. The two smokers from outside entered and closed the door. They took a few steps and joined two other men who were standing near Mrs. Cranwell, only a few feet from Wade. Five men, all large and frowning and seemingly ready for violence. And there was Doyle somewhere behind Stanley and Mrs. Cranwell, Michael, and Lawyer Wade. The stage was set. Jim walked over to the bed, kissed Michael on the forehead, then turned and said, "Recognize him, Lawyer Wade?" Stanley could only nod. "He's 11 years old now," Jim said, gently touching his son's arm. "Still blind, still brain damaged. We don't know how much he hears and understands, but it ain't much. He'll smile once a week when he hears his mama's voice, and sometimes he'll smile when Doyle tickles him. But we don't get much of a response. Are you surprised to see him alive, Lawyer Wade?" Stanley was staring at some cardboard boxes stuffed under Michael's bed, and he did so to avoid looking at the child. He was listening with his head turned to his right, because his right ear wasn't working, as far as he could tell. His ears were still traumatized from the gunshot, and if faced with lesser problems, he might have spent time worrying about a loss of hearing. "Yes," he answered truthfully.
"I thought so,"
Jim said. His high-pitched voice had settled down an octave or two. He was not agitated now. He was at home, in front of a friendly crowd. He said,
"Because at trial you told the jury that Michael wouldn't reach the age of 8. 10 was impossible, according to one of the many bogus experts you trotted into the courtroom. And your goal, Lawyer Wade, was obviously to shorten his life and lessen the damages, right? Do you recall all this, Lawyer Wade?"
"Yes." Jim was pacing now back and forth alongside Michael's bed, talking to Stanley, glancing at the four men bunched together along the wall. He said,
"Michael's 11 now, so you were wrong, weren't you, Lawyer Wade?"
Arguing would make matters worse. And why argue with the truth? Lawyer Wade said, "Yes."
"Lie number one," Jim announced, and held up an index finger.
Then he stepped to the bed and touched his son again.
"Now, most of his food goes through a tube, a special formula. Cost $800 a month. Becky can get some solid foods down him every now and then. Stuff like instant pudding, ice cream, but not much. He takes all sorts of medications to prevent seizures and infections and the like. His drugs cost us about $1,000 a month. 4 times a year we haul him to Memphis to see the specialist. Not sure why, 'cause they can't do a damn thing. But anyway, off we go, 'cause they tell us to come. $1,500 a trip. He goes through a box of diapers every 2 days, $6 a box, $100 a month, not much, but when you can't always afford them, then they're pretty damned expensive. A few other odds and ends, and we figure we spend $30,000 a year taking care of Michael."
Jim was pacing again, laying out his case and doing a fine job. His hand-picked jury was with him. His numbers sounded more ominous this far from the courtroom.
"As I recall, your experts scoffed at the numbers. Said it would take less than $10,000 a year to care for Michael. You recall this, Lawyer Wade?"
"I think so, yes."
"Can we agree that you were wrong? I have the receipts."
"They're right over there," Becky said, pointing to the black metal cabinet, her first words. Wade said, No, I'll take your word. Jim thrust forward two fingers.
Lie number two. Now, the same expert testified that a full-time nurse would not be necessary. Made it sound like little Michael would just lie around on the sofa like some zombie for a couple years, then die and everything would be fine. He disagreed with the notion that Michael would require constant care. Becky, you want to talk about constant care?
Her long hair was all gray and pulled into a ponytail. Her eyes were sad and fatigued. She made no effort to hide the dark circles under them. She stood and took a step toward a door next to the bed. She opened it and pulled down a small, fold-away cot.
This is where I sleep almost every night. I can't leave him because of the seizures. Sometimes Doyle will sleep here, sometimes Jim. But somebody has to be here during the night. The seizures always come at night. I don't know why.
She shoved the cot back and closed the door and continued, I feed him four times a day, an ounce at a time. He urinates at least five times and has at least two bowel movements. You can't predict when. They happen at different times. 11 years now, and there's no schedule for them. I bathe him twice a day, and I read to him, tell him stories. I seldom leave this room, Mr. Wade. And when I'm not here, I feel guilty because I should be. The word constant doesn't begin to describe it.
She sat back down in her old recliner at the foot of Michael's bed and stared at the floor.
Jim resumed the narrative.
Now, as you will recall, at trial, our expert said that a full-time nurse would be required. You told the jury this was a bunch of baloney. Hogwash, I believe is what you said. Just another effort by us to grab some money. Made us sound like a bunch of greedy bastards. Remember this, Lawyer Wade?
Stanley nodded. He could not remember the exact words, but it certainly sounded like something he would say in the heat of a trial.
Three fingers. Lie number three, Cranwell announced to his jury. Four men with the same hair color, hard faces, and well-worn dungarees as Jim. Clearly, they were all related. Jim continued, I made $40,000 last year, Lawyer Wade, and I paid taxes on all of it. I don't get the write-offs you smart folks are entitled to. Before Michael was born, Becky here worked as a teacher's assistant at a school in Caraway, but she can't work now, for obvious reasons. Don't ask me how we get by, because I can't tell you. He waved at the four men and said, We get a lot of help from friends and local churches. We get nothing from the state of Mississippi. It doesn't make much sense, does it? Dr. Train walked away without paying a dime. His insurance company, a bunch of crooks from up north, walked away without paying a dime. The rich folks do the damage, then get off scot-free. You care to explain this, Lawyer Wade?
Stanley just shook his head. There was nothing to be gained by trying to argue. He was listening, but he was also jumping ahead to the point in the near future when he would be forced to again beg for his life.
Let's talk about another lie, Cranwell was saying. Our expert said we could probably hire a part-time nurse for $30,000 a year. And that's the low end. 30 for the nurse, 30 for other expenses, a total of 60 a year, for about 20 years. The math was easy, $1.2 million. But that scared our lawyer because no jury in this county has ever given $1 million. Highest verdict at that time, 8 years ago, was something like $200,000. And that got slashed on appeal, according to our lawyer. Assholes like you, Mr. Wade, and the insurance companies you whore for, and the politicians they buy with their big bucks, make sure that greedy little people like us and the greedy lawyers we hire are kept in place. Our lawyer told us that asking for $1 million was dangerous because nobody else in Ford County has $1 million, so why give it to us? We talked about this for hours before the trial and finally agreed that we should ask for something less than $1 million. $900,000. Remember that, Lawyer Wade?
Stanley nodded. He did, in fact, remember.
Cranwell took a step closer and pointed down at Stanley. And you little son of a bitch.
You told the jury we didn't have the courage to ask for $1 million, that we really wanted $1 million because we're trying to profit from our little boy. What was your word, Mr. Wade? It wasn't greed. You didn't call us greedy. What was it, Becky? Opportunistic, she said. That's it. You pointed at us sitting there with our lawyer, 10 feet from you and the jurors, and you called us opportunistic. I never wanted to slap a man so hard in my life. And with that, Cranwell lunged forward and backhanded Stanley with a vicious slap across his right cheek. His eyeglasses flew toward the door. You rotten, miserable piece of scum, Cranwell growled. Stop it, Jim, Becky said. There was a long, heavy pause as Stanley shook off the numbness and tried to focus his eyes. One of the four men reluctantly handed him his glasses. The sudden assault seemed to stun everybody, including Jim. Jim walked back to the bed and patted Michael on the shoulder. Then he turned and stared at the lawyer. Lie number four, Lawyer Wade. And right now I'm not sure I can remember all your lies. I've read the transcript 100 times, over 1,900 pages in all, and every time I read it, I find another lie. Like, you told the jury that big verdicts are bad because they drive up the cost of health care and insurance. You remember that, Lawyer Wade? Stanley shrugged as if he wasn't sure. Stanley's neck and shoulders were aching now, and it hurt even to shrug. His face was burning. His ears were ringing. His crotch was still wet. And something told him that this was only round one, and round one would be the easy part. Jim looked at the four men and said, You remember that, Steve? Steve said, Yep. Jim said, Steve's my brother, Michael's uncle. Heard every word of the trial, Lawyer Wade, and he learned to hate you as much as I did. Now, back to the lie. If juries return small verdicts, or no verdicts, then we're supposed to enjoy low-cost health care and low-cost insurance. Right, Lawyer Wade? That was your brilliant argument. Jury bought it. Can't let those greedy lawyers and their greedy clients abuse our system and get rich. No, sir. Gotta protect the insurance companies. Jim looked at his own jury and said, Now, fellas, since Lawyer Wade got a zero verdict for his doctor and his insurance company, how many of y'all have seen the cost of health care go down? No volunteers from his jury. Jim said, Oh, by the way, Lawyer Wade, did you know that Dr. Train owned 4 Mercedes at the time of the trial? One for him, another for his wife, a couple for his 2 teenagers? Did you know that? No. Well, what kind of lawyer are you? We knew that. My lawyer did his homework, knew everything about Train. But he couldn't bring it up in court. Too many rules. 4 Mercedes. I guess a rich doctor deserves that many. Cranwell walked to the file cabinet, opened the top drawer, and removed a 3-inch stack of papers tightly compressed in a blue plastic binder. Stanley recognized it immediately because the floor of his office was littered with the blue binders. Trial transcripts. At some point, Cranwell had paid the court reporter a few $100 for his own copy of every word uttered during Dr. Train's trial for medical malpractice. Do you recall juror number 6, Lawyer Wade? No. Cranwell flipped some pages, many of them tabbed and highlighted in yellow and green. He said, Just looking at the jury selection here, Lawyer Wade, at one point my lawyer asked the jury pool if any one of them worked for an insurance company. One lady said yes, and she was excused. One gentleman, a Mr. Rupert, said nothing and got himself picked for the jury. Truth was, he didn't work for an insurance company because he just retired from an insurance company after 30 years. Later, after the trial and after the appeal, we found out Mr. Rupert was the biggest defender of Dr. Train during deliberations. Said way too much. Raised hell if any of the other jurors as much as mentioned giving Michael some money. Ring a bell, Lawyer Wade? No.
Are you sure? Cranwell suddenly put down the transcript and took a step closer to Stanley. Are you sure about that, Lawyer Wade?
I'm sure.
How can that be?
Mr. Rupert was an area claimsman for Southern Delta Mutual for 30 years. Worked all over North Mississippi.
Your firm has represented a lot of insurance companies, including Southern Delta Mutual. Are you telling us you didn't know Mr. Rupert?
Another step closer. Another slap on the way. I did not, Wade said.
Fingers thrust in the air. Lie number 5, Cranwell announced, and waved his tally at the jury. Or is it 6? I've already lost count.
Stanley braced for a punch or a slap, but nothing came his way. Instead, Cranwell returned to the file cabinet and removed 4 other binders from the top drawer.
Almost 2,000 pages of lies, Lawyer Wade, he said as he stacked the binders on top of each other.
Wade took a breath and exhaled in relief because he had momentarily escaped the violence.
He stared at the cheap linoleum between his shoes and admitted to himself that once again he had fallen into the trap that often snared so many of the educated and upper-class locals when they convinced themselves that the rest of the population was stupid and ignorant. Cranwell was smarter than most lawyers in town and infinitely more prepared. Armed with a handful of lies, Cranwell was ready for more. And of course, Lawyer Wade, we haven't even touched on the lies told by Dr. Train. I suppose you're going to say that's his problem, not yours.
He testified, I did not, Stanley said, much too quickly.
Cranwell offered a fake laugh. Nice try. He's your client. You called him to testify, right?
Yes.
And before he testified, long before that, you helped him prepare for the jury, didn't you?
That's what lawyers are supposed to do.
Thank you. So the lawyers are supposed to help prepare the lies.
It was not a question, and Stanley was not about to argue.
Cranwell flipped some pages and said, Here's a sample of Dr. Train's lies, at least according to our medical expert, a fine man who's still in the business and who didn't lose his license and who wasn't an alcoholic and drug addict and who didn't get run out of the state. Remember him, Lawyer Wade?
Yes.
Dr. Parkin, a fine man, you attacked him like an animal. Ripped him up in front of the jury, and when you sat down, you were one smug little bastard. Remember that, Becky?
Of course I do, Becky chimed in on cue.
Here's what Dr. Parkin said about the good Dr. Train. Said he failed to properly diagnose labor pains when Becky first arrived at the hospital, that he should not have sent her home, where she stayed for 3 hours before returning to the hospital while Dr. Train went home and went to bed, that he sent her home because the fetal monitor strip was non-reactive, when in fact he had misread the strip, that once Becky was in the hospital and once Dr. Train finally got there, he administered Pitocin over the course of several hours, that he failed to diagnose fetal distress, failed again to properly read the fetal monitoring strips, which clearly showed Michael's condition was deteriorating, and that he was in acute distress, that he failed to diagnose that the Pitocin was creating hyperstimulation and excessive uterine activity, that he botched a vacuum delivery, that he finally performed a cesarean some 3 hours after one should have been performed, that by performing the cesarean too late, he allowed asphyxia and hypoxia to occur, and that the asphyxia and hypoxia could have been prevented with a timely and proper cesarean. Any of this sound familiar, Lawyer Wade?
Yes, I remember it.
And do you remember telling the jury, as a fact, because you as a brilliant lawyer are always accurate with your facts, that none of this was true, that Dr. Train adhered to the highest standards of professional conduct, blah, blah, blah.
Is that a question, Mr. Cranwell?
No, but try this one. Did you tell the jury in your closing arguments that Dr. Train was one of the finest doctors you had ever met, a real star in our community, a leader, a man you'd trust with your family, a great physician
who must be protected by the fine folks of Ford County. Remember this, Lawyer Wade? It's been 8 years. I really can't remember. Well, let's look at page 1574, Book 5, shall we?
Cranwell was pulling on a binder, then flipping pages. He said, "You want to read your brilliant words, Lawyer Wade? They're right here. I read them all the time.
Let's have a look and let the lies speak for themselves."
He thrust the binder at Stanley's face, but the lawyer shook his head and looked away.
It could have been the noise, the stifling tension in the room, or simply the broken circuits and his faulty wiring, but Michael suddenly came to life. The seizure gripped him from head to toe, and in an instant he was shaking rapidly and violently. Becky jumped to his side without a word, and with a sense of purpose that came from experience. Jim forgot about Lawyer Wade for a moment and stepped to the bed, which was jerking and clicking, its metal joints and springs in need of lubrication. Doyle materialized from the back of the room, and all three Cranwells tended to Michael and his seizure. Becky cooed soothing words and gently clutched his wrists. Jim kept a soft rubber wedge in his mouth. Doyle wiped his brother's head with a wet towel and kept saying, "It's okay, bro. It's okay." Stanley watched as long as he could, then leaned forward on his elbows, dropped his jaws into his hands, and studied his feet. The four men to his left stood like stone-faced sentries, and it occurred to Stanley that they had seen the seizures before. The room was growing hotter, and his neck was perspiring again. Not for the first time, he thought about his wife. His abduction was now well into its second hour, and he wondered what she was doing. She could be asleep on the sofa, where she had spent the past 4 days, battling the flu with rest and juices and more pills than normal. Yes, there was an excellent chance she was out cold, yet to realize he was running late with dinner, if you could call it that. If conscious, she had probably called his cell phone, but he'd left the damn thing in his briefcase, in his car, and besides, he tried his best to ignore it when he wasn't at work. He spent hours each day on the phone and hated to be bothered after he left the office. There was a remote chance she was actually a bit worried. Twice a month, he enjoyed a late drink at the country club with the boys, and this never bothered his wife. Once their children moved away to college, Stanley and his wife quickly fell out of the habit of being ruled by the clock. Being an hour late, never early, was perfectly fine with them. So Stanley decided, as the bed rattled and the Cranwells tended to Michael, that the chances of a posse roaming the back roads searching for him were quite slim. Could the abduction in the Wright Price parking lot have been seen by someone who then called the police, who were now in full alert? Possible, Stanley admitted, but 1,000 cops with bloodhounds couldn't find him at this moment. He thought about his will. It was up to date, thanks to a law partner. He thought about his 2 kids, but couldn't dwell there. He thought about the end and hoped it happened abruptly with no suffering. He fought the urge to argue with himself over whether or not this was a dream, because such an exercise was a waste of energy. The bed was still. Jim and Doyle were backing away while Becky bent over the boy, humming softly and wiping his mouth.
"Sit up," Jim suddenly barked. "Sit up and look at him."
Stanley did as he was told. Jim opened the lower drawer of the file cabinet and shuffled through another collection of paperwork. Becky silently crouched into her chair, one hand still on Michael's foot. Jim removed another document, flipped pages while they all waited, then said, "There's one final question for you, Lawyer Wade. I'm holding here the brief you filed with the Supreme Court of Mississippi, a brief in which you fought like hell to uphold the jury's verdict in favor of Dr. Train. Looking back, I don't know what you were worried about.
According to our lawyer, the Supreme Court sides with the doctors over 90% of the time. That's the biggest reason you didn't offer us a fair settlement before trial, right? You weren't worried about losing a trial, because a verdict from Michael would be thrown out by the Supreme Court. In the end, Train and the insurance company would win. Michael was entitled to a fair settlement, but you knew the system wouldn't let you lose. Anyway, on the next to last page of your brief, here's what you wrote. These are your words, Lawyer Wade, and I quote, "This trial was conducted fairly, fiercely, and with little give and take from either side. The jury was alert, engaged, curious, and fully informed. The verdict represents sound and deliberate consideration. The verdict is pure justice, a decision our system should be proud of." With that, Cranwell flung the brief in the general direction of the file cabinet. "And guess what?" he asked. "Our good old Supreme Court agreed. Nothing for poor little Michael, nothing to compensate, nothing to punish dear Dr. Train, nothing." He walked to the bed, rubbed Michael for a moment, then turned and glared at Stanley. "One last question, Lawyer Wade, and you'd better think before you answer, because your answer could be real important. Look at this sad little boy, this damaged child whose injuries could have been prevented, and tell us, Lawyer Wade, is this justice, or is it just another courtroom victory? The two have little in common." All eyes were on Stanley. He sat slumped in the awkward chair, his shoulders sagging, his lousy posture even more evident, his trousers still wet, his wingtip shoes touching each other, mud around the soles, and his unflinching stare straight ahead at the matted and unruly mop of black hair atop the hideous forehead of Michael Cranwell. Arrogance, stubbornness, denial, all would get him shot, though he had no illusions of seeing the morning sun. Nor was he inclined to stick with his old thoughts and training. Jim was right. Train's insurance company had been willing to make a generous offer before trial, but Stanley Wade would have no part of it. He rarely lost a jury trial in Ford County. His reputation was that of a hardball litigator, not one who capitulates and settles. Besides, his swagger was bolstered by a friendly Supreme Court. "We don't have all night," Cranwell said. "Oh, why not?" Stanley thought. "Why should I hurry along to my execution?" But he instead removed his glasses and wiped his eyes. They were moist not from fear, but from the harsh reality of being confronted by one of his victims. How many others were out there? Why had he chosen to spend his career screwing these people? He wiped his nose on a sleeve, readjusted his glasses, and said, "I'm sorry. I was so wrong." "Let's try again," Cranwell said. "Justice or a courtroom victory?" "It's not justice, Mr. Cranwell. I'm sorry." Jim carefully and neatly returned the binders and the brief to their proper places in the file cabinet drawers and closed them. He nodded at the four men, and they began to shuffle toward the door. The room was suddenly busy as Jim whispered to Becky. Doyle said something to the last man out. The door sprang back and forth. Jim grabbed Wade by the arm, yanked him up, and growled, "Let's go." It was much darker outside as they moved quickly away from the room around the house. They passed the four men, who were busy near a utility shed, and as he looked at their shadows, Stanley heard clearly the word, "Shovels." "Get in," Jim said as he pushed Stanley into the same Ford truck. The pistol was back, and Jim waved it near Stanley's nose and promised, "One funny move, and I'll use this." With that, he slammed the door and said something to the other men.
There were several hushed voices as the mission was organized. The driver's door opened, and Jim hopped in, waving his pistol. He pointed it at Stanley and said, "Put both hands on your knees, and if you move either hand, then I'll stick this in your kidney, pull the trigger. It'll blow a sizable hole out the other side. Do you understand me?"
"Yes," Stanley said, as his fingernails clawed into his knees.
"Don't move your hands. I really don't want to make a mess in my truck, okay?"
"Okay, okay."
They backed along the gravel drive, and as they drove away from the house, Stanley saw another truck leaving, following them. Evidently, Cranwell had said enough because he had nothing to say now. They sped through the night, changing roads at every opportunity, gravel to asphalt, back to gravel, north, then south, east, and west. Though Stanley didn't look, he knew the pistol was ready in the right hand while the left one handled a truck. He continued to clutch his knees, terrified any move would be considered a false one. His left kidney was aching anyway. He was sure the door was locked, and any clumsy effort to jerk it open simply would not work. That, plus Stanley was rigid with fear. There were headlights in the right-hand mirror, low beams from the other truck, the one carrying his death squad in their shovels, he presumed. It disappeared around curves and over hills, but always returned.
"Where are we going?" Stanley finally asked.
"You're going to hell, I reckon." That response took care of the follow-ups, and Stanley pondered what to say next. They turned onto a gravel lane, the narrowest yet, and Stanley said to himself, "This is it." Deep woods on both sides, not a house within miles, a quick execution, a quick burial, no one would ever know. They crossed a creek, and the road widened.
"Say something, man. You're going to do what you want, Mr. Cranwell, but I'm truly sorry about Michael's case," Stanley said.
But he was certain his words sounded as lame as they felt. He could be sincerely drenched with remorse, and it would mean nothing to the Cranwells. But he had nothing left but words. He said, "I'm willing to help with some of his expenses."
"You're offering money?"
"Sort of. Yes. Why not?
I'm not rich, but I do okay. I could pitch in. Maybe cover the cost of a nurse."
"So let me get this straight. I take you home, safe and sound, and tomorrow I stop by your office and have a chat about your sudden concern over Michael's support. Maybe we have some coffee, maybe a donut, just a couple of old pals, not one word about tonight. You draw up an agreement, we sign it, shake hands, I leave, and the checks start coming."
Stanley could not even respond to the absurd idea.
"You're a pathetic little creep, you know that, Wade? You'd tell any lie in the world right now to save your ass. If I stopped by your office tomorrow, you'd have 10 cops waiting on me with handcuffs." "Shut up, Wade. You're just making things worse. I'm sick of your lies."
How exactly could things get worse?
But Stanley said nothing. He glanced at the pistol. It was cocked. He wondered how many victims actually saw their own murder weapons in those last horrible seconds. Suddenly, the darkest road in the thickest woods crested on a small rise, and as the truck barreled forward, the trees thinned, and there were lights beyond, many lights, the lights of a town. The road ended at a highway, and when they turned south, Stanley saw a marker for State Route 374, an old winding trail that connected Clanton with the smaller town of Caraway. 5 minutes later, they turned onto a city street, then zigzagged into the southern section of town. Stanley soaked up the familiar sights. A school to the right, a church to the left, a cheap strip mall owned by a man he'd once defended. Stanley was back in Clanton, back home, and he was almost elated. Confused, but thrilled to be alive and still in one piece. The other truck did not follow them into town. A block behind the Right Price, Jim Cranwell turned into the gravel lot of a small furniture store. He slammed the truck in park, turned off the lights, then pointed the gun and said,
Listen to me, Lawyer Wade. I don't blame you for what happened to Michael, but I blame you for what happened to us. You're scum, and you have no idea of the misery you've caused. A car passed behind them, and Cranwell lowered the gun for a moment. Then he continued, "You can call the cops, have me arrested, thrown in jail, and all that, though I'm not sure how many witnesses you can find. You can cause trouble, but those guys back there will be ready. A stupid move, and you'll regret it immediately." Stanley said, "I'll do nothing. I promise. Just let me out of here." "Your promises mean nothing. You go on now, Wade. Go home, and then go back to the office tomorrow. Find some more little people to run over. We'll have us a truce, me and you, until Michael dies." "Then what?" Jim just smiled and waved the gun closer. "Go on, Wade. Open the door, get out, and leave us alone." Stanley hesitated only briefly and was soon walking away from the truck. He turned a corner, found a sidewalk in the darkness, and saw the sign for the Right Price. He wanted to run, to sprint, but there were no sounds behind him. He glanced back once. Cranwell was gone. As Stanley hustled toward his car, he began to think about the story he would tell his wife. 3 hours late for dinner would require a story. And it would be a lie, that was certain. Quiet Haven. The Quiet Haven retirement home is a few miles outside the city limits of Clanton, off the main road north, tucked away in a shaded valley so that it cannot be seen by passing motorists. Such homes near such highways pose significant dangers. I know this from experience because I was employed at Heaven's Gate outside Vicksburg when Mr. Albert Watson wandered off and found his way onto a four-lane where he got hit by a tanker truck. He was 94 and one of my favorites. I went to his funeral. Lawsuits followed, but I didn't stick around. These patients often wander. Some try to escape, but they're never successful. I don't really blame them for trying, though. My first glimpse of Quiet Haven reveals a typical 1960s flat roof, red brick, run-down building with several wings and the general appearance of a dressed-up little prison where people are sent to quietly spend their final days. These places were once generally called nursing homes, but now the names have been upgraded to retirement homes and retirement villages and assisted living centers and other such misnomers. Mamas at the retirement village sounds much more civilized than "we stuck her in a nursing home." Mamas at the same place, now it just sounds better, at least to everyone but Mama. Whatever you call them, they're all depressing. But they are my turf, my mission, and every time I see a new one, I'm excited by the challenges. I park my ancient and battered Volkswagen Beetle in the small empty parking lot in front. I adjust my black-framed 1950s-style nerd glasses and my thickly knotted tie, no jacket, and get out of my car. At the front entrance, under the sheet metal veranda, there are half a dozen of my new friends sitting in deep wicker rocking chairs, watching nothing. I smile and nod and say hello, but only a couple are able to respond. Inside, I'm hit by the same thick, putrid, antiseptic smell that wafts through the halls and walls of every one of these places. I present myself to the receptionist, a robust young woman in a fake nurse's uniform. She's behind the front counter, going through a stack of paperwork, almost too busy to acknowledge me. "I have a 10 o'clock appointment with Mrs. Wilma Drell," I say meekly. She looks me over, doesn't like what she sees, and refuses to smile. "Your name?" Her name is Trudy, according to the cheap plastic badge pinned just above her massive left breast, and Trudy is precariously close to becoming the first name on my brand new shit list. "Gilbert Griffin," I say politely, "10 a.m. "Have a seat," she says, nodding at a row of plastic chairs in the open lobby. "Thank you," I say, and proceed to sit like a nervous 10-year-old. I study my feet, covered in old white sneakers and black socks. My pants are polyester. My belt is too long for my waist. I am, in a nutshell, unassuming, easily run over, the lowest of the low. Trudy goes about her business of rearranging stacks of paper. The phone rings occasionally, and she's polite enough to the callers. 10 minutes after I arrive, on time, Ms. Wilma Drell swishes in from the hallway and presents herself. She, too, wears a white uniform, complete with white stockings and white shoes with thick soles that take a pounding because Wilma is even heavier than Trudy. I stand, terrified, and say, "Gilbert Griffin." "Wilma Drell," she says. We shake hands only because we must. Then she spins and begins to walk away, her thick white stockings grinding together and creating friction that can be heard at some distance. I follow like a frightened puppy, and as we turn the corner, I glance at Trudy, who's giving me a look of complete disdain and dismissal. At that moment, her name hits my list at number one. There's no doubt in my mind that Wilma will be number two, with the potential of moving up. We wedge into a small cinder block office, walls painted government gray, cheap metal desk, cheap wooden credenza, adorned with Walmart photos of her chubby children and haggard husband. She settles herself behind the desk and into an executive swivel, as if she's the CEO of this exciting and prosperous outfit. I slide into a rickety chair that's at least 12 inches lower than the swivel. I look up. She looks down. "You've applied for a job," she says, as she picks up the application I mailed in last week. "Yes," I say. "Why else would I be here?" "As an attendant, I see you've had experience in retirement homes." "Yes, that's correct," I answer. On my application, I listed three other such places. I left all three without controversy. There are about a dozen others, though, that I would never mention. The reference checking will go smoothly, if it happens at all. Usually there's a half-hearted effort to place a couple of calls. Nursing homes don't worry about hiring thieves or child molesters or even people like me, guys with a complicated past. She says, "We need an attendant for the late night shift, from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m., 4 days a week. You'll be in charge of monitoring the halls, checking on the patients, caring for them in a general way." "That's what I do," I say, "and walking them to the bathroom, mopping floors after they've made a mess, bathing them, changing their clothes, reading them stories, listening to their life histories, writing letters, buying birthday cards, dealing with their families, refereeing their disputes, arranging and cleaning their bedpans. I know the routine." "Do you enjoy working with people?" she asks, the same stupid question they always ask, as if all people were the same. The patients are usually delightful. It's the other employees who find their way onto my list. "Oh, yes," I say. "Your age is 34, I say. "You can't do the math. My date of birth is question number 3 on the application." What she really wants to say is, why does a 34-year-old man choose to pursue such a demeaning career? But they never have the guts to ask this. She says, "We're paying $6 an hour. That was in the ad. She offers this as if it were a gift. The minimum wage is currently $5.15. The company that owns Quiet Haven hides behind the meaningless name of HVQH Group, a notoriously sleazy outfit out of Florida. HVQH owns some 30 retirement facilities in a dozen states and has a long history of nursing home abuse, lawsuits, lousy care, employment discrimination, and tax problems, but in spite of such adversity, the company has managed to make a mint. "That's fine," I say, "and it's really not that bad. Most of the corporations that operate chains start their bedpan boys at minimum wage, but I'm not here for the money, at least not the modest wages offered by HVQH. She's still reading the application. "High school graduate? No college?" "Didn't have the opportunity." "That's too bad," she offers.
plucking her teeth and shaking her head in sympathy. "I got my degree from a community college," she says smugly. And with that, Ms. Wilma Drell hits the list hard at number two. She'll move up. I finished college in 3 years, but since they expect me to be a moron, I never tell them this. It would make things far too complicated. Postgrad work was done in 2 years. "No criminal record," she says, with mock admiration. "Not even a speeding ticket," I say. If she only knew. True, I've never been convicted, but there have been some close calls. "No lawsuits, no bankruptcies," she muses. It's all there in black and white. "I've never been sued," I say, clarifying a bit of language. "I've been involved in a number of lawsuits, but none in which I was a named party." "How long have you lived in Clanton?" she asks, in an effort to drag out the interview and make it last more than 7 minutes. She and I both know that I'll get the job because the ad has been running for 2 months. "A couple of weeks," I say. "Came here from Tupelo." "And what brings you to Clanton?" You gotta love the South. People seldom hesitate to ask personal questions. She really doesn't want the answer, but she's curious as to why someone like me would move to a new town to look for work at $6 an hour. "Bad romance in Tupelo," I say, lying. "Needed a change of scenery." The bad romance bit always works. "I'm sorry," she says, but she's not, of course. She drops my application on the desk and says, "When can you start work, Mr. Griffin?" "Just call me Gil," I say. "When do you need me?" "How about tomorrow?" "Fine." They usually need me right away, so the instant start date is never a surprise. I spend the next 30 minutes doing paperwork with Trudy. She goes about the routine with an air of importance, careful to convey the reality that her rank is far superior to mine. As I drive away, I glance at the forlorn windows of Quiet Haven and wonder, as always, how long I will work there. My average is about 4 months. My temporary home in Clanton is a two-room apartment in what was once a flop house, but is now a decaying apartment building one block off the town square. The ad described it as furnished, but during my initial walkthrough, I saw only an army surplus cot in the bedroom, a pink vinyl sofa in the den, and a dinette set near the sofa with a round table about the size of a large pizza. There's also a tiny stove that doesn't work, and a very old refrigerator that barely does. For such amenities, I promised to pay the owner, Miss Ruby, the sum of $20 a week in cash. Whatever. I've seen worse, but not by much. "No parties," Miss Ruby said with a grin as we shook hands on the deal. She's seen her share of parties. Her age is somewhere between 50 and 80. Her face is ravaged less by age than by hard living and an astounding consumption of cigarettes, but she fights back with layers of foundation, blush, rouge, mascara, eyeliner, lipstick, and a daily drenching of perfume that, when mixed with the tobacco smoke, reminds me of the odor of dried, stale urine that's not uncommon in nursing homes. Not to mention the bourbon. Just seconds after we shook hands, Miss Ruby said, "How about a little toddy?" We were in the den of her apartment on the first floor, and before I could answer, she was already headed for the liquor cabinet. She poured a few ounces of Jim Beam into two tumblers and deftly added soda water, and we clinked glasses. "A highball for breakfast is the best way to start the day," she said, taking a gulp. It was 9 a.m. She fired up a Marlboro as we moved to the front porch. She lives alone, and it was soon obvious to me that she was a very lonely woman. She just wanted someone to talk to. I rarely drink alcohol, never bourbon, and after a few sips, my tongue was numb. If the whiskey had any impact on her, it wasn't obvious, as she went on and on about people in Clanton I would never meet. After 30 minutes, she rattled her ice and said, "How about some more Jimmy?" I begged off and left soon thereafter. Orientation is led by Nurse Nancy, a pleasant old woman who's been here for 30 years. With me in tow, we move from door to door along the north hall, stopping at each room and saying hello to the residents.
Most rooms have two. I've seen all the faces before. The bright ones happy to meet someone new. The sad ones who couldn't care less. The bitter ones who are just suffering through another lonely day. The blank ones who've already checked out of this world. The same faces are on the south wing. The back wing is a little different. A metal door keeps it secured, and Nurse Nancy enters a 4-digit code on the wall to get us through. These are the more difficult ones, she says softly. A few Alzheimer's, a few crazies, really sad. There are 10 rooms with one patient each. I am introduced to all 10 without incident. I follow her to the kitchen, the tiny pharmacy, the cafeteria where they eat and socialize. All in all, Quiet Haven is a typical nursing home, fairly clean and efficient. The patients appear to be as happy as you could expect. I'll check the court dockets later to see if the place has ever been sued for abuse or neglect. I'll check with the agency in Jackson to see if complaints have been filed, citations issued. I have a lot of checking to do, my usual research. Back at the front desk, Nurse Nancy is explaining visitation routines when I'm startled by the sound of a horn of some variety. Watch out, she says, and takes a step closer to the desk. From the north wing, a wheelchair approaches at an impressive speed. In it is an old man, still in his pajamas, one hand waving us out of his way, the other squeezing the bladder of a bike horn mounted just above the right wheel. He is propelled by a crazed man who looks no older than 60, with a large belly hanging out from under his t-shirt, dirty white socks, and no shoes. Quiet, Walter, Nurse Nancy barks as they fly by, oblivious to us. They speed off into the south wing, and I watch as other patients scurry to their rooms for safety. Walter loves his wheelchair, she says. Who's the pusher? I ask. Donnie Ray. They must do 10 miles a day up and down these halls. Last week they hit Pearl Donovan and near about broke her leg. Walter said he forgot to honk his horn. We're still dealing with her family. It's a mess, but Pearl is thoroughly enjoying the attention. I hear the honk again, then watch as they wheel around at the far end of the south wing and head back to us. They roar by. Walter is 85, give or take a year. With my experience, I can usually get within 3 years of their age, Miss Ruby notwithstanding, and he's having far too much fun. His head is low, his eyes are squinted, as if he were going 100 miles an hour. Donnie Ray is just as wild-eyed, with sweat dripping from his eyebrows and gathering under his arms. Neither notices us as he goes by. Can't you control them? I ask. We tried, but Walter's grandson is a lawyer, and he raised a ruckus, threatened to sue us. Donnie Ray flipped him over one time, no real injuries, but we think maybe a slight concussion. We certainly didn't tell the family. If there was more brain damage, it wasn't noticeable. We finish orientation precisely at 5 p.m., quitting time for Nurse Nancy. My shift begins in 4 hours, and I have no place to go. My apartment is off limits because Miss Ruby has already fallen into the habit of watching out for me, and when I'm caught, I'm expected to have a little touch of Jimmy on the front porch. Regardless of the hour of the day, she's always ready for a drink. I really don't like bourbon. So I hang around. I put on my white attendance jacket and speak to people. I say hello to Ms. Wilma Drell, who's very busy running the place. I stroll down to the kitchen and introduce myself to the two black ladies who prepare the wretched food. The kitchen is not as clean as I would like, and I begin making mental notes. At 6 p.m., the diners begin their protracted arrivals. Some can walk with no assistance whatsoever, and these proud and lucky souls go to great lengths to make sure the rest of the seniors are reminded that they are much healthier. They arrive early, greet their friends, help arrange seating for those in wheelchairs, flit from table to table as quickly as possible. Some of those with canes and walking carts actually park them at the door of the cafeteria so their colleagues won't see them. The attendants help these to their tables. I join in, offering assistance and introducing myself along the way.